10:06.
I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. On Friday, the Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs, Eric Shinseki, apologized before resigning amidst a growing scandal about secret wait lists and wide-scale mismanagement at a number of centers. This was after an IG report saying that 42 VA medical facilities were under investigation for delaying patient care and falsifying patient records. We asked Colby Bazell to join us. He's the author of My War, Killing Time in Iraq and Lost in America, A Dead-End Journey. He wrote a piece in the New York Times last week titled Thank You for Being Expendable. And Colby Bazell, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Do you think all this publicity about long wait times and even the resignation of Eric Shinseki will bring about needed reforms at the VA?
I hope so, but I mean, the VA has a long history of could do better, and we'll see. We'll see if this creates enough anger for people to want to change the VA so that veterans, when they need help or medical treatment, can go down there and get treated. Right now, it's from my experience. Every time, it's hit or miss. Sometimes I'll get. See somebody and get real good treatment. Other times I'm on a wait list and forced to wait and, you know, have bad experiences once I get through.
How angry are you?
I'm pretty angry about it, but I mean, I've been angry about this for a while. I mean, every time I've had to deal with the VA, it's been frustrating. And it's, you know, I'm glad that this issue is out and people are aware of that this is going on. I mean, I think a lot of veterans know that dealing with the VA at times can be a nightmare, and I'm just glad that this is out in the open so people can be aware of this.
Let me read just the first couple of sentences of the piece that you wrote last week in the Times. You said, years after I first returned from Iraq and started having thoughts and visions of killing myself, I called the Department of Veterans Affairs. They always put me on hold. And then you go on to describe being on hold for, you know, many, many minutes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I only call the VA when I'm in really bad shape. I don't really call them if I have stomach problems or anything like that. And every time, it's like they put you on hold and hear this automated message telling you, you know, thank you for serving. The VA is here to help you. If you're having thoughts of suicide, please call 911. And then when you finally do get through or they transfer you to the wrong person or whatever, you know, they set you up for an appointment that sometimes it's like 2 months away, and I'll be like, look, I'm in pretty bad shape. I need to see somebody now. Is that the soonest you could see me? And they always tell me, you know, that's the earliest we could see you is 8 or 12 weeks away from now. And, you know, that's always been frustrating.
So what would you do during that wait period?
A lot of times I would just say, you know, forget it, and I would just skip out on the appointment. Or not even said it because I'd be so frustrated. And sometimes if I'm in real bad shape, I'll just go down to VA and go in the emergency room and tell them the situation. And, you know, my experience is that's sometimes the only way to be seen is to go about it that way.
Do you think your experiences are typical, Colby?
Well, a lot of times on the news, you know, I'll hear about soldiers, you know, committing suicide while waiting for help for the VA, or sometimes I've read articles where soldiers have put on their uniform and gone to the front steps of the VA and, like, blew their head off, you know, and killed themselves. And, you know, it doesn't surprise me at all that, you know, sometimes you get so frustrated and hopeless that, like, you know, the VA is there to help soldiers, you know, when they come back. I mean, that's part of our commitment as a country is to, you know, support our veterans once they come back, and no, it's not surprising at all.
The title of your piece, Thank You for Being Expendable, was actually something that another soldier said to you while you were waiting for service. Can you describe that conversation?
Yeah, every time I go to the VA, you know, they have a waiting room, and you sit and wait, sometimes for hours, and you know, it's nothing but veterans, and you know, and a lot of times, you know, you just strike up conversations with the person next to you because it's something to do while waiting. And I was talking to this Vietnam veteran, and, you know, he was telling me, you know, we're complaining about the wait time, and he's explaining to me what thank you for your service meant. He's like, you know what thank you for your service meant? He's like, what they really mean is thank you for being expendable. You know, look at how they treat us now. Like, we're forced to wait, and he's just explaining to me that, you know, soldiers are expendable in war, but they're also expendable when they come back.
Are there
His impression of how our country treats us is, you know, expendable.
Are there certain people or institutions that you feel particularly angry and resentful of?
I don't know about one institution or maybe politicians. Like, a lot of times, you know, there'll be, you know, things where we could do to improve the VA. My impression is they're understaffed and they're not equipped. You know, the VA's being flooded with these new veterans from the Iraq War and Afghanistan, and they're just not prepared for that, and they're trying to make do with what they've got, and, you know, they need more people, more funding, and, you know, politicians are okay to send soldiers off to war, but we're reluctant to pay the cost that's attached to that once they come back.
Once you got to see someone, and obviously these are your unique individual experiences, Colby, would you say you got good care, you got minimal care, once you actually saw a medical personnel at a facility?
It's like rolling the dice. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. Like, sometimes I've had really, you know, there's a lot of great people that work for the VA, and there's also, you know, I've had experiences where I've walked out of the VA kind of shaking my head going, you know, I you know, feeling as if I left worse off than when I entered the VA. And that's frustrating because you really don't know what kind of care you're going to receive. You know, sometimes it's really good, sometimes it's really bad.
You wrote a piece in Esquire about basically being told you were going to be going back to Iraq, and this is something you clearly did not want to do. And a staff psychologist wrote a pretty convincing letter why you shouldn't be sent back.
Yeah, that was one good experience. I mean, I was in pretty bad shape, you know, being recalled, you know, and I went down to the VA, explained to them my situation, and she gave me an assessment. She asked me about a lot of questions about what it's like being back, you know, and I told her, you know, I just stick to myself. I don't really go out. I'm kind of detached. And yeah, I showed that paperwork to the Army when they wanted to send me back. And I didn't go back to Iraq the second time because of that.
Do you still have thoughts of suicide?
No, I mean, they're just thoughts in passing, which is weird because I never really had, you know, I don't have those thoughts. And then when times are bad, all of a sudden you get these weird thoughts of, like, you know, jumping off a bridge or jumping in front of a bus, and it's like, whoa, why am I getting these thoughts? And it's weird. Like, when I first came back from Iraq, first couple of years was fine. I was all excited, you know, glad to be back, glad to be out of the Army, the war's behind me. But then all of a sudden, like, things start getting dark.
Getting dark meaning you just feel as if life is not worth living, or you can't see a future for yourself?
Yeah, all that. It just sort of creeps up on you. And that was strange. And you know, first I thought, you know, whoa, what's going on? And then I talked to several of my platoon buddies that I went and served with, and we talk on the phone and stuff. They're also, some of them are going through the same things. Like, sometimes they'll call me and be like, whoa, Colby, last night, you know, I had a couple drinks, and I put my pistol out, and I put it to my head, and I thought about, you know, pulling the trigger, and I was like, whoa, you know. And, you know, so I think it's not just me that, you know, getting these weird thoughts. It's other guys I know, too, that went out there and served, you know, get those weird thoughts as well.
Do you have a therapist? I mean, is a therapist at the VA, for instance, someone that you can see on a regular basis?
At times, I mean, before when I was in bad shape, I'd go down to VA. And, you know, there's good people that work for the VA and help, but, like, you know, sitting around a group therapy or a therapist and talking, like, I mean, it helps, I guess, but I don't know. I always quit after a couple months of doing that. Because it's kind of hard. It's like I want to put the war behind me and all that stuff and then just sit down and talk about it. Like, it's not something I enjoy doing.
You do write about it. You wrote My War, Killing Time in Iraq, and also Lost in America, Dead End Journey. Do you find writing helps you?
Yeah, for me, writing's very therapeutic because you could just, you know, sit down and really think about what happened and just let it all out. For me, that's been the best therapy ever since coming back from Iraq, is writing about, the war and coming back from the war. And, because I don't really talk about it to people. Mm-hmm. I kind of a quiet person. I don't really, explain to people my experiences in Iraq or what it's like to be back. But, in front of a keyboard, I'm, mm-hmm. able to put it all out.
And then you get interviewed on the radio.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah, it's fine. It's also in a way that I guess that is therapeutic, for me to just talk about it,
So we're going to be talking with a couple of journalists who've been looking at the shortages and the crisis, the scandal that's been brewing at the VA. From your perspective, and even if it's possible to speak for other people who have served in Iraq and Afghanistan or more recent wars, what are you going to be looking for, Colby?
Change to happen with the VA. I mean, it'll be interesting to see what happens now that, Shinseki resigned and, all these people are frustrated with the VA and it's getting a lot of media publicity. And, it's really, be really interesting to see what happens to the VA now and if it'll be sustained. And we kind of have a short attention span. Maybe next month we'll be focused on another issue and, forget about our veterans again. But it'll be interesting to see what happens to the VA after this.
Obviously looking for very specific things, which is ensuring a better wait time for people looking for services, as you were looking for services when you were feeling so badly.
Yeah, I feel like there would be a lot of veterans alive today if the wait time wasn't as long as it is now. A lot of these guys, read the articles, they're waiting for help for the VA and they didn't get it, so they killed themselves. And just from my experiences going down there for help and being told to wait and we ask a lot of our soldiers. They go out and we have a commitment to take care of them when they come back, and when we don't, we lose veterans.
We're almost have to say goodbye to you, Colby, but it sounds like you rely on your fellow soldiers who have served for support.
Yeah, I talk to them a lot, but, mostly for support, I don't really have any. The VA a little bit for medical, but support, for me, it feels like you're kind of out on your own kind of thing. I don't really have support from anyone in that regard.
Including family.
Yeah.
Well, I hate to end on that note, but Colby, I first of all, I wish you the best, and I thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
All right, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. That's Colby Bazell. He served as an infantryman in the U.S. Army during the Iraq War, author of My War and also Lost in America. And yes, we have two reporters waiting in the wings talking more about the scandal at the VA. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Amtrak, featuring patripsbytrain.com, offering train packages to destinations along Amtrak's Keystone Service Line. More information on available excursion packages at patripsbytrain.com.
The Los Angeles quartet Warpaint wouldn't call their sound dance music, but the band's hypnotic vocals and driving rhythms make holding still impossible.
We wanted to move with our music. We wanted to enjoy playing our music and have that movement and move people, even if it's not outright four on the floor. Although sometimes it is.
Love is to die.
That's Warpaint singer and guitarist Emily Kokel. The band joins us this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. That recent report on fair trade was shocking to many. We'll take a deeper look with the author.
What we found was very striking and surprising to us, which was that wages and working conditions on average were worse in the areas dominated by fair trade certified producer organizations.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Support for WHYY comes from the new Wells Fargo Propel World American Express card, designed to bring the world within reach for Wells Fargo customers. Details at a local Philadelphia area branch or wellsfargo.com/propel. Wells Fargo, the world is open. Keep exploring.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. The Veterans Administration is a sprawling healthcare system with about 150 medical centers, almost 900 clinics that see 230,000 patients a day. It has come under fire because of charges of falsifying patient records, keeping secret waiting lists, and widespread mismanagement at a number of facilities. That growing scandal is the reason that VA Secretary Eric Shinseki resigned on Friday. Joining us now are Aaron Glantz. He's a staff reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting, who's been covering veterans and domestic military issues for some time now, author of a number of books, including The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. Aaron Glantz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you.
Also with us, Mark Thompson. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who covers national security and the military for Time. And Mark Thompson, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here, Marty.
Mark, let me begin with you, and I'll begin with the question I put to Colby Bazell, who we just said goodbye to. Do you think the resignation of VA Secretary Eric Shinseki is going to reduce wait times at VA hospitals?
Of course not. I mean, you've got an institution with 300,000 people in it. Shinseki was a bobber on a fishing line floating atop a stormy ocean. And he was trying to do his best, but as we learned last week when the interim report from the IG came out saying that the problems across the system were systemic, his position basically became untenable because he had told Congress 2 weeks earlier that it was just a couple of isolated cases.
To you, Aaron, and you've done a lot of reporting on this, and it seems clear, at least as an outside observer, that Eric Shinseki cares a lot about veterans. The question is, why didn't he know what was going on? Do you have the answer to that?
Well, I think that is exactly the question, especially because these are old problems at the VA. These are problems that existed before Eric Shinseki became the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Before President Obama was elected, there were reports by the agency's Inspector General in 2005 and 2007 talking about how VA schedulers manipulated data to make it seem like veterans were getting prompt appointments for medical care when they really weren't. And then there were more Inspector General and GAO reports on this topic after Shinseki came in. So when this topic blew up in the media and the secretary seemed surprised by it, mm-hmm. I think that was what caused people to lose confidence in him, that these are problems that he should have known about, he should have been working on for the last 6 years, and, you know, we should be on our way to solving them, if not already solved by now. And instead, you know, we're in the same place, if not worse, you know, than we were when he took on the job. But, you know, as Mark says, 300,000 employees, 150 hospitals, hundreds of clinics, a new boss isn't necessarily going to solve any of these problems right away.
Let me pick up on what Aaron was just saying, Mark. And since 2005, the IG, the Inspector General of the VA, has issued something like 18 reports. So we're talking about 18 reports in a decade.
Yeah, I mean, primarily General Shinseki's problem, as he acknowledged Friday morning, was I trusted the people under me. Now, some of his friends say, well, that's because he spent 38 years in uniform. Those of us who have covered the military for a long time know there's a lot of subterfuge and baloney that goes on in the military, so we don't know how much that count for his obtuseness on this issue. I mean, some people suggest, you know, his Asian background, you know, his desire to shrink and not to assert. I mean, come on, it's tough to make policy by soundbite, but that's what the political leaders were demanding. I mean, just as Shinseki and the Bush and the Obama administration were ignoring what was going on, so was Congress. So it's somewhat disingenuous for these guys to get up now and beat their chests because all of these IG reports went to the Congress. It was only after sort of a spark was ignited, as Aaron suggests, by media coverage, that it really became a cause célèbre.
In fact, Mark, you have written that the problems at the VA have really been the problems that we have had in our current wars, where we didn't have enough troops on the ground. In fact, it was Eric Shinseki who raised that question right before the Iraq War, soldiers complaining they didn't have enough protective armor. So this is just the way we both wage war and then deal or treat our veterans?
Well, if we, as a soldier famously told Don Rumsfeld, why are we dealing with this hillbilly armor? In Kuwait in 2003 and 2004, it's plain that we deal with hillbilly medical care when our soldiers and veterans come home. I mean, just review the bidding. Because we don't have a draft, because we had a relatively small army, we had to recycle soldiers and Marines back and forth to both wars countless times. That drove up all sorts of both physical and mental maladies. That drove up the requirement for military mental health professionals, which by 2005, 2006 were overwhelmed. So these soldiers were not getting the help they needed, and suicides, pathologies, drug use, divorce were all skyrocketing. Mm-hmm. Well, by the time they got out of the military and out of uniform and into the VA, some 2 million of them, that was overwhelmed. So at each step in the process, we went in with too little. Now, the nation is always very eager, it seems, to go to war. But it's like writing a book, you know, the first day is the best. And everything after that, maybe we don't have to do everything we thought we were going to have to do. And that, of course, is the crime of the American way of waging war.
Aaron, I'd be curious about your response to that, but I'm also looking at a piece that you wrote just a month or two ago for the Center for Investigative Reporting. The VA pays out $200 million for nearly 1,000 veterans' wrongful deaths, and this is just one of a number of pieces that you have been doing looking at the VA. Are you saying that they died because they didn't get care, or they died essentially waiting for the care that they needed?
Well, we put this piece out actually shortly before the current scandal erupted, because you know, people have for years, as Mark's been saying, been complaining about problems at the VA, and so we wanted to ask a very simple question, which was that how many people were actually dying as a result of these problems, and we figured out the best way was if the VA, the government, had been forced to spend our tax money compensating a family in a wrongful death claim. Then that was probably a pretty good indication. So we found 1,000 cases in the decade after 9/11. About 250 of them were related to delays in care. Then there were some that were just clear mistreatment, maltreatment of veterans, veterans who jumped off the roofs of psychiatric wards. Veterans who had botched surgeries by doctors who should have clearly never been hired by the agency because they had lost their licenses in other states, things like that. And that plays in to actually part of my reaction to what Mark was saying is I totally agree with him that this was a war that was started on the cheap and that we, you know, when we started the Iraq War in 2003, you know, having already been at war in Afghanistan, there was no real plan to treat the wounded when they came home from war. But what concerns me, and what also concerns, I think, a lot of members of Congress, is that under President Obama, we have been spending a lot more money on the VA and on the care for our veterans. And it's not necessarily translating into better care. So the VA's budget has gone up 40%. Under the Obama administration. And if you look at the number of doctors and nurses per patients that there are now compared to the ratios before 9/11, they're not any worse. They're about the same. And so the question that people are wondering is, if you are in charge of a hospital and you game the system to make sure, to make it look like veterans are getting appointments that they're not getting, if you have a lot of wrongful deaths at your hospital that should have never occurred. What happens to you? You get fired, you get replaced, you get demoted. Is there some system put in place to make sure that these problems don't occur again and that the veterans who come after you get higher quality medical care from more dedicated professionals? And I think that's where Shinseki fell down the most, is that, you know, you're talking about a huge hospital system. It's not enough just to hire people and tell them to go do the job. You have to be on them. You have to be on the hospital directors to make sure they're doing a good job, and then all the way down, you know, to the receptionist who greets the veteran when they come to the door to make them feel like they're welcome instead of, you know, giving them some kind of runaround. Mm-hmm. And that just hasn't happened during the administration of President Obama.
Mark, let me pick up on what Aaron was just saying, but and sort of extrapolating from that. So what kind of care should a veteran expect in this country?
Well, it is an expanding panoply of care that veterans get. That was partly Shinseki's fault. He expanded exposure to Agent Orange to cover type 2 diabetes and other issues that, you know, generally grow in a Vietnam-era population regardless of where you serve. But once you've made that commitment, and that was part of the problem here, when Shinseki and company said, you're going to be seen and get your appointment within 14 days, mm-hmm. several years ago, number one, that doesn't happen in the private sector. Number two, the VA is expanding. Why should it be taking on that challenge right now? Number three, just like when you take teachers and you make them give their students the state tests, you know, teachers end up teaching to the tests, and the kids don't learn the things they should. In the same way, when you've got that 14-day deadline, and that becomes the be-all, end-all of lots of things, including how well your hospital is rated within the VA system, and it plays a role in bonuses that are paid to the leaders of those individual medical centers, lots of, for lack of a better word, cheating, fudging, cooking the books is going to go on to ensure you get as close to that 14-day deadline as you can. And the real problem here, I think, is when you're a boss and you impose such a constraint or such a requirement, you know, human nature being what it is, that people are going to try to get around it. And that means you have got to be on your guard to ensure it doesn't happen. And of course, as we now know, there was a 9-page memo in 2010 that read like, you know, a bookie sheet of how to cheat the system, and there were calls, hey, make sure this stops. That was 4 years ago, and it never stopped, and in fact has gotten worse.
And that's
Mark, you know, you've looked
go ahead, Aaron.
I don't know if you've seen the official data, but it's like 95% of veterans at almost every hospital are being seen in 14 days, according to this official data, right? And you talk to any veteran who ever wants to go get a VA appointment for anything, and nobody ever gets an appointment that fast, right? People wait weeks or months, or they rarely get in the door really quickly. And if you're the boss of this agency, and you're getting these reports with these numbers, I mean, how disconnected from reality mm-hmm. do you have to be to know that these official numbers do not represent at all the experience of millions of veterans using your hospital system? And so, I mean, that's the thing that it doesn't pass the gut check. It doesn't pass the smell test. The reason that we at the Center for Investigative Reporting never did any journalism using these official numbers is because we knew they were junk. And you know, for the secretary to be shocked and surprised that the numbers are misleading, you know, shows, I think, a really catastrophic lack of understanding of his own agency that he was overseeing.
Mark, but go ahead.
I think that's right, Aaron, but also let's remember, Shinseki was criticized for being rather insular. You know, he brought in a team. They didn't mate well with the VA bureaucracy, which in some ways is a good thing because the VA bureaucracy has a lot of shortcomings. But plainly, as you suggest, there were parallel universes here, and somebody somewhere has got to be pointing that out. The IG was pointing it out. Shinseki basically fundamentally ignored it. You just knew he was in trouble on May 15th when he said, you know, this is not a big problem, when anybody with access to a computer and the VA OIG website could have checked and seen, my God, you know, what's happening here is not what this guy, the top guy, is saying. And, you know, people like Jeff Miller on Capitol Hill were raising Cain about this for a long period of time.
But, Mark, do you think more people should either resign or lose their jobs over this?
I don't know. I think it's more systemic than individual. Plainly, anybody who did anything that hurt veterans needs to go and needs most likely to be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. I mean, how else can you tolerate it? And not only that, it's the notion that there was a pecuniary and monetary incentive to fudge these numbers, which, oh, by the way, not only did that give you more money, it gave ailing vets less health care. I don't know what more pernicious combination of things there can be in the wake of two big wars than those two facts.
Aaron, we have an email from Pez who says the government does not have enough money. We have effectively, systematically underfunded the VA, but as you said, the VA has gotten billions of more dollars in the last number of years.
Yeah, what I've seen is that, you know, under Bush, I think the VA was really underfunded in that we started two major wars and did not really, until the Walter Reed scandal, begin to pay to care for the wounded. But, you know, now, here we are, you know, 7 years after the Walter Reed scandal, and we've been spending a lot more money, and members of Congress who have been appropriating this money are now looking around and asking themselves, why are things not better? You know, since we have been writing big checks for years to care for veterans, you know, why is that not translating into better health care? And I think that this current scandal, all the lying that's going on, it could end up really hurting veterans if, you know, congressional confidence in the VA is reduced to such an extent where they're no longer willing to hire more doctors and nurses and you know, people to care for veterans if they feel that money isn't going to be spent well. So I think it's a real critical time for the agency. You know, President Obama put in somebody who is going to show some real leadership, that person have deputies who are also going to show real leadership, or else it could be a real bad time ahead for the agency and veterans.
Mark, we're almost having a break here, but is there someone in mind, you think, that will be heading up the VA?
Nobody willing to take it, based on the
really?
Folks I'm talking to. I mean, you know, Jim Webb's name, the former senator and secretary of the Navy, has been named. Pete Chiarelli, the Army general, who did a lot of good work on Army mental health's name has come up. Michelle Flournoy's name has come up, the former number three at the Pentagon, although her husband, Scott Gould, recently stepped down as number two at the VA, and I think they want a change in conversation at their dinner table. But I do think the problem, getting back, Marty, to what you were asking about, are individuals or is the system culpable? As Aaron pointed out, you know, spending has gone way up. And going back to 9/11, which, you know, frankly wasn't that long ago, to today, the VA budget has tripled from roughly $50 billion a year to $150 billion a year. That is a phenomenal amount of money. If you talk to VA doctors and outside doctors who have worked at the VA, you realize that VA doctors just don't see as many people as private doctors do.
Well, Mark, hold on to that thought, only because we're almost up on a break here. That's Mark Thompson, Aaron Glantz. A very short break, and then we'll be back to our conversation talking about the VA health system.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY. The National Constitution Center is the museum of We the People, featuring the acclaimed multimedia show Freedom Rising, Signers Hall, and the story of We the People through artifacts, a rare copy of the Constitution, and interactive exhibits. Now through October 19th, Slavery at Jefferson's Monticello, a powerful exhibition that follows six enslaved families who lived and worked at Jefferson's plantation. More at 215-409-6700 or constitutioncenter.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Denzel Washington and LaTanya Richardson Jackson. They're co-starring on Broadway in A Raisin in the Sun. Washington plays the role originated by Sidney Poitier, who he went to for advice.
He was funny because he was like, I'm not going to tell you what to do. And then he'd start trying to remember lines.
Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We all talk about how stress is contagious, but now we're even learning that we can get it from a TV monitor. A new study has found that even watching someone under stress can cause it in us. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll talk with the author of that study and others about what we can do to keep from taking in contagious stress. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Mark Thompson. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter. He covers national security and the military for Time. Aaron Glantz, a staff reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting, has been covering veterans and domestic military issues. And we are talking about what's wrong with the VA health system and if and whether and how it can be fixed. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY. Radio Times. Mark, do you want to finish your thought?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, when you talk, Marty, about what's wrong at the VA, I think as we're halfway through, we also need to mention what's right with the VA. Access to care has been terrible, but most people who get in it like it. They deem it to be better than the private health care. I think that's important. Getting back to what we were saying earlier was the notion that, you know, VA doctors and medical professionals don't seem to deal with as many patients as those in the private sector. And that's because a lot of VA doctors, they'll tell you, have to do a lot of inane paperwork, have to do a lot of scheduling, have to tend to a lot of issues that could be done a little bit lower on the totem pole and allow doctors to see more people. Plainly, it seems to me like the choke point in getting care for our veterans has been the lack of primary care physicians in the VA, and it's roughly 10%. So they've only got 90% of the people they need, and when you have all these veterans rushing in, that 10% shortage adds up pretty big, pretty quick.
Do you think, Aaron, that the medical personnel shortage helps explain the problems at the VA? I'm also thinking a couple of years ago, those pictures of the paperwork, you know, piled up, basically looking like they were going to break floors. Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Talking about the paperwork issue is an important thing to mention. That was a story that we broke at the Center for Investigative Reporting,
right,
that the number of veterans waiting more than a year for their compensation benefits had gone up 2,000% under President Obama, and that despite more than $500 million spent on a computer system to digitize these compensation claims, 97% of them remained on paper, and in fact, there was so much paperwork piling up in the VA office in North Carolina that it was compromising the structural integrity of the federal building.
Right.
So we came out with a story that showed the backlog was a lot worse than anybody had thought for disability benefits at the VA, and there was 200 members of Congress plus who wrote to President Obama demanding presidential leadership. There was a national media frenzy, much like this one. You know, everyone from The Daily Show to Fox News got involved. Secretary Shinseki responded. A lot of bureaucrats were fired. The computer system was actually launched. Workers at all of the VA benefits offices were forced to work overtime for months. And now the backlog is a lot smaller than it was a year and a half ago. So when people look at an example like that, they say, we don't necessarily need more money. What we need is leadership. You know, when the secretary actually led and he said it was a priority, the agency did a lot of work to solve the problem with the resources they already had. And then when they see, you know, not that far later, the same sort of scandal erupt on the healthcare side, it begs the question, is this really a resources issue or is it a leadership issue? We had at the Center for Investigative Reporting the head of the psychiatric department at the VA in St. Louis come forward and talk about how he was demoted and forced to work in the basement after he insisted that the other psychiatrists at the St. Louis VA spend more than 3 hours a day seeing patients. You know, they were spending a lot of time on their academic research, on going to meetings, on taking long lunches. And he said, hey, we got to focus on seeing veterans. You guys got to see way more patients than you're seeing right now. As Mark said, a lot of them see much fewer patients than they would in the private sector. And it's not because veterans are getting longer, more in-depth appointments. And so we need to have a new world at the VA where an individual like this is promoted and valued instead of demoted. And I think that, you know, hopefully that can come with new leadership at the top, but it needs to be focused and sustained attention, you know, from the president and from people on Capitol Hill, and that they not just move on because, you know, they cut off the head of the agency.
Mark, let me ask you a question, and then I do want to get to some of our callers here, because in many ways we've been focusing on returning vets, but we're also talking about retiring vets. And these are soldiers, Marines that fought in the Vietnam War. They're going to the VA as well.
Yeah, and it's important to point out, Marty, that that share is the biggest chunk of the VA currently. That places the greatest demand for dollars, time, and doctors on the VA. You know, World War II vets are leaving us at an accelerating rate. There aren't that many of them anymore. We lost our last World War I vet, Frank Buckles, maybe 5 years ago. And, yes, we've got new vets coming from the post-9/11 wars, but the big hump in that python right now are the Vietnam vets. And they've got a different kind of, you know, a different panoply of problems than younger men and women have. So that requires a different sort of mindset in terms of dealing with. So you've got, you know, it's really a complicated platter of issues that the VA has to deal with, and they've just got to get better at juggling them.
Well, let me get to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. What can be done to improve care at the Veterans Administration hospitals and clinics? We have Bob joining us from Pittsgrove, New Jersey. Bob, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I've been a veteran. I'm a Vietnam veteran. So I've been dealing with them.
We have a terrible phone line. I'm going to have to bring Bob down, but I'll just read what I see here on my computer. Having dealt with the VA for over 40 years, this has been the same thing that it's always been going on since the 1970s. Some things are better, but generally it is the same. And Aaron, I mean, we've been focusing on current problems. What we're seeing from Bob, and I think from others as well, is that there's nothing new about what we're talking about.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was the frustration of a lot of the lawmakers, as we mentioned at the outset, is that this was like the 15th hearing they'd held on this very problem. And so there's no reason why these problems can't be solved. But I think, as Mark said, the lawmakers sometimes hold their hearing and then move on, you know. And so if we can, you know, focus on this a little bit longer than the current scandal, maybe we'll get some kind of solutions.
Mark, I heard Bernie Sanders on NPR. It sounds like he's going to introduce a bill that he introduced a couple of months ago. Are you sort of up on what's happening in Congress today?
Well, plainly, Congress wants improvement. Everyone's got a different idea of the way to go about it. It will be interesting to see what kind of a confirmation hearing the nominee to run DVA goes through, and it'll also be interesting to see how quickly that happens, because Sloan Gibson, the current number two, is now the acting secretary. He gets pretty high marks from most people who know and who have worked with him, both inside and outside of the agency, and, you know, with barely 2 years left in President Obama's final term, and if you're going to have lawmakers in the Senate have a really grueling confirmation hearing for the new Secretary of Veterans Affairs, I wouldn't be surprised to see the current deputy stay in there for quite a while.
Aaron, how much responsibility do you think the president bears for the current situation?
I think the president is ultimately responsible for this. One of the things that we saw when we exposed the backlog of disability claims was that here was a situation where the president campaigned saying that it was ridiculous that veterans would have to wait months for their benefits if they were disabled. He put in a lot of money to help solve that problem and then basically checked out. And then when the media spotlight was turned on it, Then the president himself responded. The president, he had meetings with Secretary Shinseki, and then Secretary Shinseki responded, and then the problem is getting solved. And so I think that, the president needs to know, and the next president, too, as Mark says, this one's term is running out, that when you have a healthcare system serving millions of American veterans, you need to give the same attention to it that you would give to other important priorities like climate change or, the wars that you're prosecuting or the federal banking system or whatever, that it takes ongoing management, and that if you check out, then, people below you notice, and those people below you are the people who are actually running the show. So when you show leadership, when you show you care, when you show you're engaged and you're the chief executive, then it really makes a tremendous difference to the veterans who are showing up at hospitals and clinics trying to get health care.
You agree with that, Mark?
Yeah, I think that's true, but I also think it's worth noting, and this is an issue that we see when we have public scandals like this. Now, I just converted my home Mac computer to the Mavericks operating system, and I'm always nervous when I do that, so I went online to read what people had to say about it. And universally, it was terrible.
Oh.
It was all terrible. Don't do it. Don't update. But when I did it, because other people said, the only people who complain are the ones who have trouble. And indeed, it went off without a hitch. In the same way, we have to ask ourselves, why did so few VSOs, Veteran Service Organizations, call for Shinseki's ouster? Beyond the American Legion, they were out there for a while pretty much by themselves. And why do random samples say between 80 and 90% of the veterans who are seen in VA hospitals are satisfied with their care? We've got to be careful that we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater by upending the VA or some fundamental pieces of the VA. What we've got to do is tinker with the parts that aren't working and make them as good as the parts that are working.
Well, we have an explosion of phone calls in only a couple of minutes. Let me get Alex from Wilmington, Delaware to join us on Radio Times. Alex, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I've received health care from the VA for many years, and I can say that one of the things that's not being discussed is that the service member needs to be proactive. They need to be proactive in trying to get their disability reviewed and trying to get their disability claim put through. They need to be proactive in getting physical help. They need to not be reactive because, like any giant monster bureaucracy, the VA healthcare system will ignore you unless you are taking care of yourself. You do have to look out for number one, and that sounds very mercenary, but I think it's also something that needs to account.
Well, Alex, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Aaron, does he have a point there?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that I would say is that, we all understand that when you're dealing with, a private HMO or something, you have to be ready to battle, and we would all hope that when it's our tax dollars paying to care for our veterans, that the fight wouldn't be so bad. But I would also agree with Mark that there's no indication that any of these problems are necessarily any worse than in the private sector.
Let me get, looks like Rick from Warminster to join our conversation. Rick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I'm a Vietnam vet and a Gulf War vet and a 20% disabled vet. And the treatment that I received at the VA was, I couldn't have asked for better. So I agree with don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think there are some factors from the Vietnam era to the current era with our wonderful warriors that go over now. First of all, we went for a year, and we stayed. These wonderful youngsters that go today go for 6 months, come back, and another group go over for 6 months. So that kind of doubles the number of the available folks you're going to have to treat. The second thing is we didn't have the protective body armor that the young folks have today, and so in many cases, what are now casualties that result in prosthesis were fatalities for us. And the third thing, I think there's much more attention on the PTSD than perhaps when we came back as individuals rather than as units where we had clinicians and we had psychiatrists who could address it. So my best to Mark Thompson. He and I have worked together for years.
Oh, interesting. Well, Rick, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Mark Thompson a chance to respond.
I knew there was a reason he was brilliant, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it.
There you go.
But I think all those points were well taken.
Anything? Well, who are you, Rick, just so we know?
I'm a retired colonel and did Vietnam as an advisor and then did the Gulf War later. But Mark and I got to know each other through NPRI, where we took a group of retired folks and we tried to continue to contribute in places like Bosnia and Africa.
Oh, well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. We have another caller that we don't really have time to put on the air, but I'll just read what he says. This is Brad from Graduate Hospital. What about discussions about privatizing care for our veterans? Aaron, do you think that would improve care for veterans?
I think that, you know, that's what I was alluding to earlier, that when you have scandal after scandal like this, it you know, is raising the question in the eyes of some lawmakers about whether or not privatizing the VA might be a good idea. I'd say that, you know, as Mark points out, nearly all veterans are supportive of the VA as an institution and are really scared when people start to talk about vouchers or something like that. They want the VA to work better than it does, but they don't want it to be dismantled.
So, Mark, are we going to be having another conversation in a couple of years when another report comes out about something about the VA?
Well, of course, that's what we do. But I think it's
what we do.
On the privatization issue. Listen, 50, 60, 70% of what the VA deals with can be handled perfectly fine in the civilian world. Give them vouchers to tend to their hearing aids. There's not an issue there that's military-specific or unique. The issues dealing with TBI, with PTSD, with gross amputations, those are issues that the military and the VA are especially good at dealing with. We should focus our efforts on that. And if we've got to funnel some off to the private sector, let's do the humdrum stuff that anybody of my age has to deal with.
On that note, Mark Thompson, as always, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Sure. My pleasure, Marty.
And he's Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. He covers national security and the military for Time. Aaron Glantz, thank you very much as well.
All right. Take care.
You too. And he's a staff reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. Wrote a book called The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out about Facebook and Twitter, podcast archives, and you can carry on a conversation on our homepage as well. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thank you so much for joining us, and do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.